Thank you. Jody didn't do what he said he was going to do. He told me he was going to say, "This is a bimbo from North Carolina." And I was prepared for that remark, but he changed it. My name is Millie, and I am an alcoholic.
I'm Millie.
A very grateful alcoholic. First, let me say this. I want to thank the committee for asking me down here. It was a delightful trip. I drove, and I got to see a lot of Georgia, and I really enjoyed it. I had no idea it was this far. I thought I was going like 300 or 400 miles. Well, it turned out to be 600 miles, so I got to see a lot of our country, and I'm grateful for this. As I said, I am a grateful alcoholic. I'm grateful to every alcoholic who ever walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether they're sober or drunk today, it doesn't make any difference. Because, you see, each one has taught me how to live. Many have taught me how not to live. And for this, I'm grateful. I would love to be able to stand up here and tell you that I was a lady when I drank, and that I passed out very gracefully in my own living room. I sipped a little sherry. But you see, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the first thing I was taught was honesty. And I can't be honest with you and tell you I was that type of drunk. I was a two-fisted, fighting Irish drunk. Loved a good argument and a fight when necessary. And I got into a lot of them. I was born and raised in Virginia, and if there are any Virginians in the room, I hope I don't step on your toes, but I have to tell it like it is. All Virginians are basically snobs. They can't help it. They're born that way. From the age of one, I was taught who my grandparents were, who my great-grandparents were, and thus and thus. It hadn't been too long ago I told my sister, that and 10 cents at that time would get you a cup of coffee, and that's all it would get you. But I had that stinking Virginia pride, and I got into a lot of trouble. Now, I tell my story, and I tell it for one reason only. I'm not trying to impress any of you old-timers. I'm not trying to impress the committee. I'm here praying with all my heart that there might be one woman in this room that I might be able to reach. That she won't have to do the things that I did. That she won't have to suffer as I suffered. And that's my only purpose in speaking. As I told you, I was born and raised in Virginia. My father was a seafaring man. And I'm not blaming my alcoholism on anything but drinking too much liquor. But I had a personality problem, even as a small child. My father had 12 children, and I wanted to be number one with my dad, and this was impossible. I worshiped this man. He had 9 daughters, and of course I was sort of in the middle, and so I was not anything special to him. But I was the only one that liked boats, and he would take me on the boat during the summer months. He had a crew on the boat. And he'd take me on the boat with him on trips in and around Norfolk. By the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I could read a compass and steer that tug down the harbor as well as my daddy could. That's the way I learned to smoke. I no longer smoke, but at that time I did. He used to puff on a pipe. And when he'd go down in the engine room or back in the galley, he'd turn the boat over to me. And I'd put his pipe in the side of my mouth and his captain's hat on, and I'd go down that harbor just like Captain H.P. And I loved every moment of it. My father was a very strict man. My father lived and died, and I never kissed him. He didn't believe in little girls sitting on his daddy's lap. And now I'm going back many years. I'm 72 years old, so I'm going back 70 years. Things were a lot different than they are today. But he was very strict with his girls and very proud of his girls. I met my husband, who since passed away, don't feel any sympathy now. Isaac was the greatest thing ever happened in my life, and I thank God that I had him for as long as I did. But I met Isaac when I was 18 years old. Now, it isn't a woman in this room doesn't know what I'm talking about. That first love, it's nothing like it. And I was in love for the first time in my life. And the captain happened to be out at sea, and Isaac and I courted for some 6 months. When the captain returned, of course, he immediately wanted to know who I was courting. And, of course, when he found out that Isaac, see, back in Virginia some 50 years ago, Catholic girls didn't date Jews. And Isaac was a Jew. And he was from the other side of the track. And so my father immediately broke it up. Then I was heartbroken. But let me go back and tell you a little something about my personality. The first drink that I ever took, I got drunk. The last drink that I took, I got drunk. So I had a problem right from the beginning. I hear a lot of people talk about social drinking. I didn't know a thing about social drinking. The only thing I knew about it, if you had a bottle, I could be darn sociable. And that's just all I know about social drinking. This family had, it was a family across the street, and it was Christmas, and I was 15 years old, and they needed a babysitter, and I went over, and they went out. And when they returned, now I'm dating myself, we had no liquor like you have today. They had corn liquor and alcohol. And when they returned, they brought some friends with them, and Mr. Jack was mixing alcohol and grapefruit juice. And like any typical teenager, I was interested in what he was doing. And my first drink, he asked me if I'd like to have one, and I said, oh yeah. Never had one in my life, never seen any drinking. There was never any drinking in my home. My father never had a drink in his life. My mother would sip a little sherry when the priest came, but that's the only drinking I ever saw, so I knew nothing about drinking. And I took that first one, and it just changed me completely inside. Because I don't like the word fat. I was a chubby teenager. And I had acne, and I was very sensitive. And that first drink immediately took away my weight. It took away my acne. I just felt great. The second one I asked for. The third one I stole. And I went home drunk for the first time in my life. Needless to say, that was the end of my babysitting for that particular family. And from then on, every time I took a drink, I got drunk. Well, when my father broke Isaac and I up, my Isaac was the type of man that would not see me without my father's permission. I think he's a little frightened of my dad, to tell you the truth. And it was during the Depression. Many of you young people won't know what I'm talking about, but things were a lot different than they are today. And I was working and I had just finished high school, and I was working in a drugstore. And prior to this, I had been ill, and some friends stopped by the house to see me. In the group was a Navy man. He was in civilian clothes. I was not aware of it. Because, you see, back then in Norfolk, a nice girl didn't associate with the Navy. And my father had made this very clear to me that if he ever caught me with a sailor, what he'd do. And I was scared to death of every sailor that ever walked the streets. Thank God World War II took care of that. The churches in the area asked the families to take the boys in for Sunday dinner. And my mother was taking some of the boys in for Sunday dinner and married off three of her daughters in the Navy. So things sort of changed. Well, some 3 or 4 weeks after that, this man walked into the drugstore I was working in, and he said, he introduced himself. I didn't recognize him, and he had just bought a new car. And he asked if I would like to see the car, and I said, yeah, I got off at 4. And he had a bottle of gin and asked if I'd like to have a drink. Well, you know what my answer was if you're an alcoholic. And we were riding around sipping on this gin, so you didn't have places to go. You didn't have cocktail lounges and all the things you have today. You drank in cars or, you know, that's the only place I ever drank liquor was in a car. And it was a place in Portsmouth, Virginia. It was called the 30th Division Club. And this was a place that all the girls whispered about at high school. So I was real curious to find out what this was all about. And he asked if I'd like to go to the 30th Division. I was thrilled to death. But it was too early to go, so we knocked off that bottle of gin and got another one. And we were riding along, and he started shooting me that line that most older men shoot young girls, you know. I fell in love with you the first time I saw you, and blah, 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 and let's get married. And I thought, well, this is a good idea. This will get even with Isaac, the captain, and my mother. So I'll marry this guy. Well, in Virginia, you have to wait 3 days. You have to have a blood test, and you have to wait 3 days. And I don't know of any active alcoholic that will wait 3 days for anything. So he said, let's go to to South Mills. That was in Carolina. I knew nothing about it. But anyhow, we went to South Mills. When we arrived, now this is the way alcoholics think. Now this is the way this one thought, and I've run into quite a few that thought just like I did. When we got there, the lock on the door was broken in the car. And I was afraid to leave the gin in the car. I was afraid somebody would steal it. I was afraid to hide it because I was afraid I couldn't find it. So I sat it right in the middle of the sidewalk so we could see it as we came out of the building. Now, that's alcoholic thinking. Any of you non-alcoholics, if your spouse tells you that they don't remember when they're drinking, you believe them. Because I'm telling you the truth. I do not remember anything about that night. I awakened the next morning to this horrible voice singing Amapola. And I'm really dating myself. And I thought, oh my God, I spent the night out, the captain will kill me. So I opened one eye, and I was so grateful I at least recognized the man. And he said, good morning, Ms. Copeland. Ms. Martin. I said, you got to be kidding. And he had the license to prove it. He said, would you like a drink? Not only did I like a drink, I needed a drink that morning. And I went on my first drunk. Now, I can't tell you how long it lasted, because I don't want to lie to you, but it was something like 3 or 4 weeks. We just drank all over, everywhere. Stayed drunk. And I reached the point, I don't know how many of you have reached that point in your drinking, but I reached the point where the booze wouldn't do anything for me. I couldn't blanket out the situation I was in. I knew I was in real trouble. So I finally called my mother, and I told her what had happened and where I'd been, and she said, Mildred, come home. Now, I love my mother dearly. God knows she never gave up on me. She always loved me, and her only excuse for me was that I was sick. She didn't know how sick I was, but that I was sick. And she always, she never gave up on me. But she was a typical Southern lady, if you know what I mean. My mother, I never saw her that she wasn't dressed. Now, I'm not saying all of this in conceit. I'm just telling you how it was. My mother never did any housework. She had someone do her housework and her cooking. And my mother was, a typical Southern lady. And she was always concerned about the neighbors, what they would think. So when I called her, she said, come home and we'll make some kind of arrangements. She didn't want the neighbors to see me or know about this situation I was in. So by the time I got there, she'd called my uncle in Washington, D.C., who was an executive with the government. And he had made arrangements for me. He found a room for me, and he was going to get me a job with the government. And she put me on a train and shipped me to Washington real fast. And I got up into Washington now. Of course, it's a different story. Every place they have bars now. But I had never seen a cocktail lounge. And boy, I'm telling you, when I walked into Washington, D.C., they had one of those on every corner. And the music and the excitement, I just loved every part of it. I couldn't wait to get it in there. I worked at the old Navy building, and I got off at 4:30 in the afternoon, and by 5 o'clock, I was in a cocktail lounge living it up until 2 o'clock in the morning. And I did this for some 10 years. And the only reason, the only excuse I have, or reasoning that I have, that the good Lord blessed me with a good body, that I could handle a lot of liquor. As I say, every time I drank, I got drunk and I got into trouble. And this one particular night, I love people. I love people today. I love people when I was drinking. And when I drank, I like a crowd around me. And I'd go in the cocktail lounge and pick up a couple of people here and go to another and pick up a couple of more people. And this particular Saturday night, I'd accumulated 15 people. And I had a key to an apartment in Rockville, which is Rock Creek, which is one of the better sections at that time in Washington, D.C. And I had a key to an apartment. People had gone to Florida, and I was to check on the apartment off and on. Well, we drank to 12 o'clock in D.C., and they cut us off. They closed the places at 12, so you could go out in Maryland and drink till 2 in the morning. So we'd drank until 2 in the morning, and we were leaving there, and we had to have one more for the road. You know how it is. So I invited all my newfound friends to this lovely apartment. I knew they had a bar. And we cleaned out the bar. And we were leaving something like 6 o'clock in the morning. And as we came out, an argument started between two of the boys. And I stepped in between the two, and somebody hit me on the chin, and I landed on the curb. And I saw lights going on all over the place. And I heard the most horrible sound back then it was to an alcoholic. A siren, and it was getting closer and closer. Now up there, they didn't send a radio car as they did in Norfolk. They sent 3 and a patrol wagon. I'd never seen a patrol wagon. Everybody got in the patrol wagon but Millie. And I told the policeman, I said, "You don't know who I am. I'm Captain H.P. Tyree's daughter, and I've never been in a patrol wagon. I have no intentions of getting in one." Well, he put me in, and we fought all the way down to the second precinct. Now, I did not have to go to jail, and I thank my God for this every day of my life. I work with a lot of girls that have been in jail. I visited many girls in jail. And I know the kind of treatment they get in jail. They do not get the kind of treatment you boys get. They're propositioned. Many things happen to them in jail. And I thank God I didn't have to experience this. As I stood in front of this judge, wasn't a judge, it was a sergeant, and I gave him a fictitious name and a fictitious address. Now, we didn't have segregation back then, and I gave him an address in a black section, and he knew I wasn't black. But he let me get by with it, and that's why I don't have a police record today, because he let me get by with it. And when I left there and I went to my room, my heart bleeds today for every woman that's out on that street that lives alone, that's looking for a drink, and the things she has to do to get it. It's an unpleasant life for a woman alcoholic, let me tell you that. But I can tell you this. Every time you see an alcoholic woman with a man, you can bet your bottom dollar he's got a bottle or the price of one, because that's all she's looking for is one more drink. It's true that isn't all she gets, but that's all she's looking for, is one more drink. I know, I've been there. It's a horrible existence. And when I returned to my room, I sat there and I thought, what am I going to do? You see, in the meantime, my father had written me a letter. And he said, Mildred. He didn't say, dear Mildred. He said, Mildred, as far as I'm concerned, you're dead. I do not want you to return to Norfolk. If you do, I will personally see that you are put away. And he didn't mean any of these lovely rehab centers we got today. He meant Williamsburg, which is a nut house in Virginia. And I knew exactly what he meant. Do not correspond with your mother or your sisters. And he signed it, not Daddy or Dad, Captain H.P. Tyree. Now, you'd think that would really shake me up, do something to me. But, you know, I used to carry that around in my bag. And I could sit at the bar, and my money would get a little short. And I could whip that thing out. Now, I don't know if you'll be as honest as I try to be, but I would conjure up a couple of tears. You know, we're the greatest con artists in the world. I believe this. And I could conjure up a couple of tears, and I'd read this letter with all the gestures, and then the drinks would flow like wine, you know. I wore it plumb out. But that morning sitting there, I thought, well, I can't go back to Norfolk. I can't stop drinking in Washington. All my friends drink. See, I was young. I was only 30 when I came into AA. I knew that I was around 27, somewhere around there. I did like most alcoholics. I wanted out of life. There was no point in living anymore if I could not drink. So I slashed my wrist. And I've always been grateful to God. He's removed a lot of scars through age, except this one. And he's left it there. And I never do my dishes or take a bath or look at my arm that I don't bow my head and ask God to forgive me. I've always been ashamed of that, and it's always been hard for me to talk about it. Because, you see, I was taking the very thing that God had given me, my life. Well, I started on this arm, and this one was bleeding so bad it just shot to the ceiling. And I went next door and got one of my girlfriends, and she took me to a doctor. And this doctor, as he was suturing my arm, he said, young lady, I don't know what faith you belong, but you need some help. And I thought, that makes sense. But you see, we can con ourselves so fast. I called a priest and made an appointment. I didn't go to communion and go to confession like I should have. I just called him, met him in his study. And I told him as much as I wanted him to know, but not the whole story. And back then, they knew nothing about alcoholism as far as women were concerned. We were just morally bad people. We were not sick as the men were. And he told me, he said, young lady, why don't you come back to the church, get active, and learn to drink sensibly? And that's the only answer the boy had. But you see, this is the way an alcoholic thinks. When I got in trouble with that marriage and I drank gin, I immediately blamed it on gin. And they say, an alcoholic doesn't have the willpower, don't you believe that? I never took another drop of gin until the day I married Isaac Copeland. I knew it was a husband in every bottle, and I was scared to death of it. So I eliminated gin from my diet. Now I was in trouble with booze. And by the time I left his study and walked out of the front door, I had convinced myself that it was booze that did this. I would not drink any booze. So then I started drinking nothing but beer and wine. And I get so tickled when I go on a 12-step call and a gal will tell me, well, I only drink a few beers. Well, I got news for you. You can get into just as many fights and arguments and trouble with a tummy full of beer and wine, or I could, as I could with gin or booze. So it was all bad for me. I went back to booze. I never went back to gin. It's always been an odd thing to me. I was scared to death of it, but I would drink booze. I came home on a 2 weeks vacation. Well, I had been home. See, when my father was out at sea, I could come home and see my mother and sisters. And I had been home several times. And every time I came home, I'd go to Antan looking for Isaac. I always knew where he'd be. He was a newspaper man. He'd either be at the newspaper, in his room, or in a beer tavern. So I always knew where to find him. In this particular time, I came home and I went downtown. I knew where to find him. He was standing on the corner and he was drunk. You see, I can say it now, my Isaac was an alcoholic also. And he was unclean. I had never seen him this way before. He needed to shave. His shoes weren't shined. And I stood there and just looked at him and thought, my God, is this what I have wasted my life over? So I went back to Washington with the intentions of never seeing Isaac again. 2 years later, two of my girlfriends and I took a vacation to Virginia Beach. And I called my mother, and she said Dad was out at sea, and she invited us up for dinner. And as we were leaving, Gracie said, Millie, I sure would like to have a drink. And I said, well, honey, I don't know where you can get a drink in Norfolk unless you go to a beer tavern, and nice girls can go to beer taverns. So anyhow, I said, but I know somebody who would know. So we went down looking for my Isaac. And he was standing on the corner. There's a few of you, I'm sure, in this room knew Isaac, but you didn't know him back then. He was standing on the corner. See, back then, it's popular today, but it wasn't back then. You wore your shirt, tie, and, you know, and but he used to leave his shirt sort of lay open here, you know. He wore a 16-and-a-half collar, and he had a big barrel chest. And he let that chest roll out that shirt. He had beautiful head of black hair. And I tried to clean it up. And the only way I can tell you, he was the sexiest thing I ever laid my eyes on. And he was up to the day I lost him, I can tell you. And I told Isaac we were looking for a drink, so he took us down to the American Legion. He was not drinking, and I thought, this is wonderful for him. And when he left the table, I said to the girls, you know, we're here, and we've got plenty of money, and we're on vacation. And I said, he only works for a living. He's the only poor Jew I ever knew in my life. And I said, we shouldn't let him pay for our drinks, and they agreed. So when he came back to the table, I told him, I said, Isaac, we're on vacation. We're going to pay for our own drinks. I found that he said I had a resentment for many, many years. Because later I found that he was sitting there with $400 in his pocket. I wished I had known it that night. But we paid for our own drinks. And as we sat there talking, we made a date, and he came down the beach on Wednesday, and we walked up and down the boardwalk. And he said, you know, Millie, you've never found anyone, and I've never found anyone. Why don't we say the heck with the families and get married? Now, he was 39 years old, and I was 28. Now, why we had to have permission of our parents, I don't know. And I agreed to this. I went back to Washington to settle up my affairs and quit my job. I came back, and Isaac was so happy we were going to get married, he was drunk as a skunk. But Isaac never did get drunk like I did. You know, I was falling down, fighting, messy drunk. Isaac always walked pretty steady. He just looked like a zombie. You know, he walked around half goofy all the time. But anyhow, we had to get a blood test again. And this time I was willing to wait. And this part of my talk, Isaac used to correct me, so I better stop and do it. He said, you never get rid of that first husband in your talk, Millie. Get rid of him. When I arrived in Washington, my uncle had a friend as an attorney, and he said he would handle it. Well, anyhow, he investigated it. Now, I'm going to tell you what circumstances I was married. I never really looked at the marriage certificate. But they had me down as Mildred Tyree White. Now, I don't know where the White come from. And his name was Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, and they'd put it down M-O-R-T-I-N. So we were married under fictitious names. He was under mental observation at the Naval Hospital. He was a nut. I get cold shivers when I think what could have happened. But I did get rid of him, got an annulment. And Isaac and I decided, as I say, to get married. And we had the blood test, and I had bought my lovely dress to be married in. And the most gorgeous nightgown and negligee you've ever seen. That was going to be the night of all nights. Well, they went through my damn vein in my arm and caused a terrible bruise. So I couldn't wear my dress. I had to wear a suit. And I was married in a black suit and a white blouse. Back then you wore a hat. If you just went out and put the garbage out, you put a hat on. But I had on a large picture hat, had a beautiful corsage, and white gloves. And I was sober when we got married. Isaac was half cropped. And I always teased him about it. I said, at least I was sober. He always swore I married him for his money. He had $13 in the bank. We had a lot of fun teasing each other. People never understood us. Up till he died just 6 years ago, we were married some almost 40 years, and there were still people in his family and my family saying it'll never work. But we made it, AA made it work, I tell you. So, as I say, we were married, and after the ceremony, I said, I think we ought to get a drink. I said, yeah, celebrate. Well, that's the last thing I remember. Until the next morning, I woke up in bed with my suit, my corsage, my white gloves. That was my Isaac's honeymoon. Now I started doing a little different type of drinking. I had what I wanted. Now, that sounds very selfish. I was a very selfish alcoholic. As long as I had Isaac in the bottle, I could care less what was going on in the world. And so we did a lot of home drinking. And we had 3 years. I could stand up for an hour and tell you things that happened during those 3 years are unbelievable. Some of the things I don't want to forget, so I try to talk about them every time I talk. I don't know if you did it, but I did. I was always looking for something to keep from getting so sick. And someone had told Isaac and I that if we'd take a purgative the night before, or a laxative, we wouldn't be sick. And we were drunk this night, and I said, Isaac and I was telling him about it, and Isaac would do anything I suggested. I could turn him into anything. So I got 2 8-ounce glasses, and I also had in the house was Epsom salts. So I don't know how much I put in there, and I filled it up with beer and wine and mixed it, and we drank it. Now, we only had one bathroom. Now, that's sick. I don't never want to go through that again. And I hear a lot of you boys in AA. I get so tickled when we're sitting around over here. You say, you know, I wish I was married to an alcoholic. Let me tell you something. I got news for you. If you got a good alibi, you hang on to him. Because you don't have any idea what it's like with two drunks in the same house. I don't care how much they love each other. We'd steal from each other. We'd hide liquor from each other. Now, he wouldn't do it, but I would. I'd hock anything I could get my hands on, except my wedding band. I never hocked my wedding band for some reason, but I hocked everything else. I had a ring that belonged to my grandmother, and that's always hurt me, that I hocked that and never redeemed it, and I'm sorry, because I could have passed it down in the family. But anyhow, we had three horrible years. And Isaac found Alcoholics Anonymous. And he started going to, well, in the meantime, I'd had a, see, I always wanted to make a lot of money. And I was always scheming a way to make $1 million. You see, most alcoholics, they don't think small, they think big. You sit around here and tell some of their stories. They don't ever tell a small story. It's always big. Everything's big with them. And Isaac found Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a restaurant. We drank it up. And we were living in a hotel. Now, I had not ever lived in a hotel. Now, that's paradise. You know, you can just lie right there in the bed and just pick up the phone and say, send me a pint. And you can do that all day long if you got the money. I loved living in a hotel. Had no housework. I just loved it. Isaac went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he came home that night. I'll never forget how excited he was. He had found something. And I said, honey, that's wonderful. Because, see, the thinking had started. Now, if he quits, that means more money and more liquor for you. So encourage him. So I did. I said, you go to your meetings. I think this is great. But I got thinking about making money again. So I went to his father to borrow money to buy what else but a beer tavern. And you know, people laugh at me in AA, but I think alcoholics are the smartest people in the world. When active, you know, they're really smart. Because anytime you can kind of jew out of enough money to go into business, you're a Gentile, you got to be smart. And that's what I did. But as I say, you know, I was a typical alcoholic. I thought big. I was not interested in the beer tavern itself. I didn't care whether it sold any in there or not. But I was going to start something new. See, I wanted to sell cases of beer door to door, like the Avon lady, you know. I wasn't thinking of one truck. 25 cases? No, I was thinking of 10 trucks and at least 50,000 cases a week. That was my big dream. You see, I'd been denied to go home. And my big dream was to have I always said Isaac was the only Jew in Norfolk that didn't have a Cadillac. And by golly, I was going to put him in one. But Isaac never wanted a Cadillac. Millie wanted a Cadillac. I wanted an Eldorado convertible. And I wanted a scarf at least 10 foot long around my neck that I could go down past the captain's house and give him this. And that was my big dream. And I'm serious when I say that. It was a big dream in my life. Well, I think, you know, God's always looked after me. Now, let me stop here and tell you this. I'm going to talk about God. And if you resent it, I'm sorry. Because if the word God runs you out of here, booze is going to run you back in, so you just well stay you're here. I think my God looked after me all through my... I know he did, not think. I know he looked after me, some of the situations I got into. And I think that he was looking after me then. He knew I was in trouble. And so he denied me ABC license. That was on the 1st of December, 1947. I never want to forget that date either. And I was so hurt and crushed that my father didn't love me, and I wasn't sure my mother loved me, and now the state of Virginia wouldn't let me make a living. And so you know what I did. I started drinking. And Isaac and I, he was standing around the store helping me, this beer tavern. I started complaining. And let me tell you something. If your spouse is in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't fuss at them about going to too many meetings. Let them find their way. And I began to complain. And Isaac began to miss his meetings. And this is the most dangerous thing an alcoholic can do, is to miss their meetings. his thinking changed. And that night when we went out to dinner, I ordered a Carling's ale. Did this thing go off? Can you still hear me? No, this thing's gone off.
It's back on. Try it again.
Huh?
It's on now.
Oh, it is on. Okay. I don't want y'all to miss anything. But anyhow, I said I ordered a Carling's ale. Now, a lot of you young people don't know what Carling's ale is, I'm sure. But it's green death in a bottle. See, you don't get drunk on this. You just get like a zombie and walk 2 foot off the ground, you know. And I dearly loved it. I drank it by the case. And I ordered the Carling's ale. And Isaac said, you know, Millie, I think I'll have one. And I said, well, why not? You've been going to this outfit for 3 months. Certainly they taught you something. Drink one or two and leave it alone. 23 days later, that was my longest and my hardest, and I pray to God, my last drunk. We were sitting across the table from each other, and again, someone had told Isaac and I that if you let open beer and let it sit overnight, let it get flat, that it won't return in the morning. Now, if any of you plan to drink again, and I'm sure somebody in this room is going to drink again, it works. It'll help you. So, and that morning, we were sitting there drinking that flat beer, and we were just as flat as the beer in every department of our lives. Financially, spiritually, mentally, physically, everything you can think of. And my Isaac loved me, and I say this with no conceit. This man, for 39 years, proved how much he loved me. And I think it was the hardest thing he ever had to say in his life. Because, you see, marriage to a Jew is very sacred. You hear very few Jewish divorces. And he sat there and looked at me and he said, Millie, I cannot live this way any longer. Now you take what money we have and you go back to Washington. I'm going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, this is fine, Isaac. You see, right away the wheels started turning and I got so scared inside. But you see, this was the only thing I loved on this whole earth. And I was losing him, and I knew I was losing him, and I didn't want to lose him. And as I told you, I could con him. I said, well, we'll meet for dinner and we'll talk about this. Well, we met that night and had dinner, and he felt the same way. He was still going to his AA meeting. This was on the 23rd day of December. And I said, well, I'll go to the theater and meet you after the meeting. I'd only been in there a short time when Isaac came in and knelt down beside me, and he said, Millie, you see, Isaac was a smart man. They're having a Christmas party, and all the boys had their wives there, and I certainly would appreciate it if you'd come and go with me. I thought I was going to a party. But you see, they had planned to have a meeting before the party. Now, by now, I'm sure in your mind, thinking that I'm at that time a very sophisticated, very attractive lady. Now, let me tell you what arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that's what I thought I was. I thought I was most attractive. As he said, I'm short. I weighed 230 pounds. Now, I'm only 5'4". I had flaming red hair. Now, that red hair came about during a drunk. I had a friend who had a beauty salon. I don't hear it much around AA anymore. But back then, we used to say, let's split a pint. We never said, let's go out and get a drink. We always said, we'll split a pint. So I was at the beauty shop, and I said to Mary, let's split a pint. She said, fine. And I went out and got 2 pints. I didn't get one. You know I didn't. So we'd finished most of it, and she's looking at me, and she says, you know, Millie, you'd make a heck of a redhead. I said, the heck you say? Do it. Well, she dyed it. It was beautiful. It was a strawberry blonde. It wasn't redhead. It was a strawberry blonde. And but see, they didn't have Miss Clara and all that stuff they got today. And she was so drunk she forgot the formula. And she didn't know how to keep it that color. So she gradually turned me into a redhead. So when I arrived at AA, I had flaming red hair. And I piled it real high on top of my head, you see. That was to take away from this and make me look at it. I used a cigarette holder, yay long. Oh, I see they're coming back in style now, but I wore an ankle bracelet. Now, just for a moment, think about it. I had on a black satin dress. Now, imagine black satin wrapped around all that blubber. I had a rhinestone pin that big right here. A lot of my weight was right here. And as I came through the door, I found out later, I had known this lady all my life, but she said she turned to another non-alcoholic. She's a non-alcoholic. She turned to another non-alcoholic and said, "My God, that looks like a train coming into the station." I'm sure that's what it looked like. But I didn't think so. I thought I was the sexiest thing come down the pike. And that conceit's unbelievable. I just love to sit at a bar with a mirror. Back bar with a mirror. And I could sit there and look at myself and wink at myself and say, "Hi, cutie." You know, and I'm blown like this, you know. But anyhow, I came and I listened to the meeting. It was an open meeting. And a woman spoke. She later became my sponsor. But Ada gave a talk, and I followed her and related to her up to a certain point. She went a little further with her drinking than I had gone. She was on the Bowery in New York. She had many things happen to her. But I sat there and I thought, "Young lady, you keep drinking liquor, this is exactly what's going to happen to you." So I quit that day, but I did not come into Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I had that pride that was eating me alive. And I made Isaac promise that he would never tell any of my story in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did the things that were wrong then, and they're wrong now. And if you think I'm preaching, I am preaching. I'd sit around and criticize and gossip. And you know, gossip, even if it's true, it's vicious. It can only hurt. So if you hear something about a member, don't talk to another member. Go to that person and straighten it out. Don't make it petty gossip in the group. Because I've seen criticism and gossip run people out of Alcoholics Anonymous to drink again, to die. I have buried many of them. So you think before you gossip. We don't have room for it in AA. Criticism, I've never understood how one alcoholic could criticize another one. We've all done the same things, maybe in different places, but we've all done the same things. But these things were all bad. And I think the God of my understanding said to himself, "She's in trouble. I better get her out of this." And Isaac and I were privileged to go to Natural Bridge. That's in Virginia. If you've never been there, if you're in that area, please go. This is not a man-made bridge. This bridge was put there by nature. Millions of cars go over it every day. And we were sitting there, and of course everything was in total darkness. And I had intelligence enough to know that it was a record and the voice was coming from the record. But this voice said, "He said there will be light." And lights were thrown from every direction on this mammoth creation of God. And for the first time in my adult life, I let the tears flow. See, I had learned real early that a crying woman didn't get many drinks. So I dried up my tears. But that night I let them flow. And as we left, I said to my Isaac, I'm going back to Alcoholics Anonymous and admit that I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to get drunk, Isaac. And all he said was, thank God. You see, this man had been praying for this. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, went into a closed meeting. Of course, everybody like dropped dead when I walked in. I'd only been in a short time when they asked me to speak. And don't you know I got up and told my whole story? Isaac like the fellow out of the chair. He couldn't believe it. And you know, from that day to this, it's never bothered me since. Never bothered me. The things I did, they were in the past and gone. But I did like, I'm sure not many of you have done this. I had the first step, the third step, then I immediately jumped to the 12th step. I did nothing in between. I had a big book, and I kept it dusted so you'd know that I had one, but I never read it. I was going to be one of those unique alcoholics. I could do this without all that big book stuff. And every Wednesday, Ada and I would get a carton of cigarettes, and we had very little literature back then, and we'd steal what literature we could out of the club and tie the big book and go down to the city jail. Now, Ada always made me do the talking, and they let us in. We'd go up on the second landing, and I thought women were in jail for drinking, all women. And if you've never heard of Salvation Army Lassie beat the drum any harder than Millie Copeland did every Wednesday. Admit you're an alcoholic, find God, that's it. I didn't carry any message. But you know what? The miracle was I stayed sober. That was the miracle, that it was keeping me sober. And it did keep me sober. I was sitting in a meeting one night, and one of our boys talking, and he too later died in convulsions in the Portsmouth jail. But that night he was sober and had been sober some time. And he talked about an inventory. And he didn't talk. See, I always thought an inventory meant I should run around and tell you all the places I'd been, the things I'd done. George says, no, get a paper and pencil and sit down. And take a look at your inside. Put down your character defects. And find out what you're all about. And I thought, now this makes sense. But I'm not going to let anybody know about this. See? Now Isaac's living in the house with me. And I was dumb enough to believe he didn't know any of my character defects. I mean, you know, we're really nuts. I got a cigarette and a big book and the Bible, and I took an inventory. Now, that's the toughest thing I have ever done in my life, to be completely honest with Millie, nobody else, to have to face what I really was. I tried to hedge on it. I got to the word jealousy, and I'm not jealous. I've never been jealous in my life. And I envied every woman who ever had a baby. Because I was not blessed with a child and always wanted one. But God knew best. If I'd had children, I'd never been able to do the work I've been able to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would not been able to have, you know, help drunks like I've been able to do. So he knew what he was doing by not giving me a child. So I had to put the word down, jealous. Selfish? Not me. I'd give you my right arm, but I'd get something in return. You can bet your life on that. I never will forget my husband and father-in-law had given me a nice, not an expensive, but a nice fur coat. And my niece had the gall to say that I looked like a bear in a fur coat. So I gave her the coat, never got it back. I don't know about the rest of you gals, but I never got anything back I gave away. So I had to put the words down that I didn't like. Conceited? Not me. And Isaac got that one straightened out. Pardon me, because if I went in a restaurant sober, I had to sit in a booth. Now, drunk, I'd get on the first table and do a dance. But sober, I wanted to sit in that booth. And I always said it was an inferiority complex that I felt inferior to people. And I think Isaac had finally gotten fed up with this. And one night, I said, be sure to get a booth. He said, Millie, that's not an inferiority complex you've got. It's conceit. He said, why do you think you're so important that when you walk in a restaurant, everybody stops eating just to see you make an entrance? And I had to accept that. He was right. It was conceit, the egotism. And so I started working on me. I stayed very active. Back then you had to. AA was small. We had no women. I was the only woman in that area staying sober. So everything that happened, Millie had to be a part of it because I was the only woman. Not that I was that great, but just happened to be a woman. And I think my first dividend came when they asked us to put on a radio show, an 8-minute show in Norfolk, and they had two of our boys and they wanted a woman, and of course Millie had to do it. You know, that is, tell you how typical alcoholics are. You know, we practiced for a month for 8 minutes. We will make it perfect. Well, my mother knew that I was going to be on that program. And so she had the radio on, and she said, my dad recognized my voice. And he said, May, turn the radio up. And she said he listened to it. And when it was over, all he said was, May, tell Mildred to come home. I can never thank you enough for this. You gave me 13 wonderful years of my dad. He never understood me. He never understood Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my friends asked him one time what he thought about AA. He said, I don't know. All I know is he made a lady out of Millie, and if he can do that, it's got to be good and powerful. I lost my mother before I lost my dad, and after 7 years of sobriety, I made amends to my mother. Now, maybe this sounds strange to you, but as I say, my mother was very vain. And I had a standing appointment at a beauty salon for her. She got her hair fixed every week. She got a permanent every 3 months. And she knew what I was doing. I was trying to make amends for all the gray hairs in her head. But when we lost her, she had several pieces of jewelry. And one piece, this ring, we knew where all the jewelry was going except this ring I have on. I don't know the value of it and don't care. Because my father called me, and I went over and he said, Millie, he never called me Millie, Mildred, you've given your mother more love in the last 7 years than all the other girls put together. And he said, I think that she would want you to have this ring. Now, I was the black sheep of the family, the only one that ever caused them a moment's trouble, and I got this ring. And for this, I've got to thank you. I'm so grateful for this. I've got active in AA, as I said a moment ago, and I know I'm taking a little too much time, but I've drove 608 miles, and I ain't going to cut it short. you golfers won't be late. I'll make sure you golfers get out of here in time. But I've got to tell you this, because these are some of the things that I want to share with you that helped me. As I say, I stay active. I'm just as active today as I was when I came in 41 years ago. I go to 2 meetings a week. Now, they do something up around that area. They talk about 90 meetings and 90 days and all this bit, but I go to 2 meetings a week. I've been doing it for 41 years, and it works, and I ain't going to fix it. I go to a discussion meeting, and I go to a speaker's meeting. I go to the discussion meeting like most of us, so I can open my big mouth. I go to the speaker's meeting so I can keep my mouth shut and listen. So there's a reason for both of the meetings. I stay busy. I work primarily with women. Of course, I've reached the age, thank God, not in sobriety, but in age. I'm 72 years old. And a lot of the young people are coming in AA today. And it's such a flattering thing to me that a lot of the young boys, they come to my house and they treat me like their mother. And they'll tell me things that they won't tell anybody else. They'll share things with me they can't share with young people. And I'm so privileged to be that rich. I get aggravated in AA. And I'm going to talk about women again. As I told you, it's tough for women out there on that street. Or even she does her drinking in the living room, at ballrooms, or wherever we, our bottoms rather, wherever we put, wind up. But she has it tough. And when she walks in here, don't you expect her to be a lady. You know, you have to learn when you're out there drinking. I don't care what a woman looks like, there's always that guy that's going to put the make on her. So you learn to say, mind your own, I buy my own DG drinks, and you mind your business. So you have to learn to cuss to protect yourself. I try not to cuss anymore. And I know it's difficult, because it was for me when I first come in. But if you give these girls enough love and understanding, they'll stop cursing. They'll stop using too much makeup. They'll stop tinting their hair. They'll become ladies. And only love can do this. See, I don't tell anybody how to work the 12 steps. I think each one of us have our own way of doing it. So I don't talk about that, but I talk about the thing that the alcoholic needs when they get here. Now, we accept this as a disease, but we can accept relapses, and I don't understand this. If it's a sickness, then we've got to expect relapses. And nothing bothers me any more than to have one of our boys or one of our gals go out and drink again or get sick again. And walk back in here, and somebody will greet them with, well, you think you're going to make it this time? Do you really want it this time? That isn't what an alcoholic wants to hear. An alcoholic's looking for what I was looking for, love and understanding. They want an arm around their shoulders and a shake of hand. They want to touch somebody. They want to feel that they're cared for. I don't know about you, but I know about Millie Copeland. My job is to be here with my heart and my arms open and say, welcome home, honey. Somewhere along the way, you missed the boat. Maybe this time together we can find it. That's my responsibility for the rest of my life. That's the only way I can repay you for what you've given me, is by giving it to someone else. I have never said no in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get in some terrible situations sometimes. Like this trip, I thought I was coming 400 miles and came 608 miles. But it always works out. It's always a reason for it. Alcoholics Anonymous, by my speaking, have given me many, many chances to help alcoholics. And I don't say this with any conceit. I'm just telling you that doing my job in AA is the right thing. I was telling Sterling this morning, keep talking, Sterling, don't ever stop, because we're losing speakers in AA, whether you know it or not. We're getting so many discussion groups. We're not having enough speakers groups that the new ones coming in are not getting the experience to speak before a group. So if any of you talk, keep talking. Sometimes that's the only way they find it. Now, I'm going to share some of the good things that have happened in my life. Just recently, 2 months ago, I had a man call me from Canada. And he said, I'm looking for Millie Copeland. Let me tell you this. You know, in AA, there's something again. They don't ever elect you to a job. They tell you to do it, you know. But when I moved out on the island, we had no way of letting people know how to contact our groups. In fact, coming down here, there was a couple of phone books I couldn't find AA in. And so when I moved on the island, I suggested that we convert one of our... If you've got a private line, you can convert it to a business phone. I said, and enlist Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, nobody wanted the responsibility. So I waited 6 months. We had another business meeting. And I said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll convert my phone to a business phone, enlist AA, and take the calls for a year. Well, I just gave it up a few months ago, and I had it for 21 years. Nobody wanted it. It's a little different now. We're getting a few down there that are really interested in helping people. But I enjoyed that work. I met a lot of wonderful people. And as I say, this man called me, and he said, I'm looking for Millie Copeland. And I said, you got her. And he said, you're going to think this is strange, Millie. He said, but I'm from Canada. I'm calling you from Canada. He said, I've got 26 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, sober. And he said, I have a daughter that's developed into alcoholism, into an alcoholic. And he said, I've had her in so many places. I've had so many people talk to her, and nobody could reach her. And he said, the last rehab that I put her in, they had one of your tapes, and she listened to it, and you turned her whole life around. He said, she's been sober for a year, and the only thing she wants is someday to meet Millie Copeland. And he said, would you give me permission the next time she's at this part of Canada that I can call you and put her on the phone? I said, it would be the greatest compliment I've ever had. How can I say no in AA? There may be another one just like her in this audience. And I pray God it is one, that I can help her, that I can give her something to take home and think about. As I told you, I'm not a religious person, but AA has taught me at this stage of the game, I'm trying to grow spiritually. So I read a lot, and I'll tell you what my program is and how simple it is. When I get up in the morning, I get a cup of coffee, and I've got a large picture window that looks out over the sand dunes. I say my prayers, and I pray for all of you. I pray for many people. I say the surrender to prayer, and then I say the Lord's Prayer. And then I read three books, or parts of books, prayer books, three prayer books. And then I start my day. I sit there and just listen and think, listen to my birds. I have a lot of birds down there. And I take an inventory of myself and how I'm doing, what I'm doing. Then I go in the real world. And I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. It's nothing that can upset me anymore than to sit around and hear a bunch of AA members around tax time talk about how they've, I hate to use that word, screwed the government out of money. It bothers me because AA teaches you to be rigorously honest if you want to stay sober. You can start cheating a little bit here and cheating a little bit there, and the first thing you know, you're in real trouble. You're in real trouble. And I find it's easy to be honest because I never told a lie in my life. I didn't have to tell 10 to cover up the first one. When I tell the truth, I don't have any problems. So I practice these principles. There's never a day that goes by in my life there isn't an alcoholic in my home. Some are drunk, some are sober. But I talk to an alcoholic every day of my life. And sometimes many more than that. Because everybody knows at the beach, my coffee pot goes on at 11 in the morning and goes off at 2 in the morning. And it's always there. The back door's always open. Just walk on in. I come home one day, and there was a note there, and Isaac was living then, and it said, drop by, had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and a glass of milk, and read Isaac's, that squire, see you later. And I mean, that's the way we live down there. It's the, we just have an AA house, like Sterling says. In his home's the same way. It's just beautiful to see this. And if you've not got one, you're missing an awful lot. You're missing an awful lot. Because, see, we're not getting the 12-step work today that we were getting many years ago. Most people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous today have been in a rehab, and they're already familiar with the 12 steps, and, you know, they know what it's all about. And I don't knock this. Now, a lot of people do. Anything that's going to help an alcoholic, I'm all for. I don't care what it is. And I'll tell you what rehabs have done for you. See, I used to have to take them in my home. I had them set my house on fire. I've had one make them pass at my husband. I had some bad situations happen. And so, see, these rehabs have taken all this out of your hands. You don't have to run around and try to find some doctor that'll do something for you, as we had to do. Or take four-hour shifts to sit with them in case they went into DTs. See, rehabs have released you of all this. You're lucky, really. And as I say, I stay busy, and I make my life. It is AA. You're my family. You're really my family. And it's marvelous the way the boys, when I lost my Isaac, have crowded around me. If I have any problem, they're there. And it's funny sometimes because, you know, most alcoholics, when they get sober, they're doctors, psychiatrists, lawyers, plumbers, electricians, and they become all sorts of things. And I've had so many of them that go fix something for me and break it. I just laugh and get an electrician. But they have rallied around me. They don't let me get lonely. I'm never alone, but I do get lonely. They were kidding me about driving up here, and I said, well, I wasn't alone, because the good Lord was with me, I know this, but I had Frank Sinatra and Tom Jones and George Jones. See, I carry a lot of tapes in my car, and I play a lot of tapes. I don't know what tomorrow's going to bring in my life, but I know that if I get up tomorrow morning feeling like I did this morning, that my cup will runneth over. I know that what I am this morning is God's gift to me, and what I become is my gift to God, and I thank my God for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.